Okay, now we get to the difficult part. So please fasten your seatbelts and put your tray tables in the upright position.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Ataivam Sarvesham Vedavakyanam Pramanya Evastite Kechid Evam Ahu Karya Evarte Vedasya Pramanyam Nasite Tatraiva Shakti Tat Par Yayur Avadari Tuat. Although we have thus established that all the statements of the Vedas are authoritative, some persons still might say that the authority of the Vedas is limited to matters of prescribed duties, not those of settled fact, because such persons recognize the literal meaning and purport of statements only in activity that needs to be done. Do you understand the difference between prescribed duties and matters of settled fact? Yeah. There's a statement in the Veda that fire counteracts ice. Fire melts ice. That's a statement of settled fact. And it's there in the Vedas. So Jaimini is the one who established this principle that the only really significant statements in the Vedas are those that tell you to do something. If something's already done or it's already a fact, there's no significance to it from Jaimini's point of view. What does it matter that the Vedas tell you that fire melts ice? You can learn that in grade school, or you can find it out by your own experimentation. What do you need the Vedas to tell you that? But they do say it. So the fact of them saying that doesn't serve any, it's not an essential statement of the Vedas. It's just some icing on the cake. It has some purpose, but not an essential purpose. It's called artavad. Glorification or description for some secondary purpose. And it's Jaimini and his followers, but starting with Jaimini himself, that say the literal meaning and purport of statements are only an activity that needs to be done. If I say the sun goes around its orbit every day, that's a statement of fact. If I talk to the sun and say, you better go around your orbit, then that's an injunction. The injunctions are what is significant. Anyway, that's the theory of Jaimini. Now, you can draw further conclusions from that. The Prabhakara school draws conclusions about the meaning of sentences and how you learn the meaning of words in the first place, how a child learns what a language means. Okay, so this is what is said. The some people we're talking about is the Mimamsakas, but we're specifically talking about one sub-school of the Mimamsakas. Tatra Shaktir Yata Uttama Vridhena Madhyama Vridham Udishya Gamanaya Ityukte Tam gavanayana pravittam upalabhya balo syavachasa sasnadi mat pindanayanam arta iti pratipadyate. Anantaram gam charaya ashwam anaya ityadav avapodvapabhyam goshabdasya sasnadiman artaha anayana shabdasya cha aharanam arta iti sanketam avadadayati. Literal meaning, so they say, is ascertained in this way. When an eldest person tells the next in age, bring the cow, a young boy may notice that second person proceeding to bring a cow. The boy may thus understand from the first person's words the idea of bringing an object with a dewlap and other features. And later, so he figures out what the sentence means. Doesn't know what the words mean, but he knows what the whole sentence means because he sees the result. The older person said blah, 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 some words, and the next older person brought a cow. So this blah, blah, blah must mean bring the cow. Okay. And later when the boy hears other statements like graze the cow and bring the horse, by inclusion and exclusion, he discerns the conventions that the word cow means that which has a dewlap, and that bringing means fetching. So by comparing similar sentences, same in some ways and different in other ways, he figures out what the individual words mean, but only from first understanding the whole meaning of the sentence. He doesn't learn words in isolation. He learns them in the context of the sentence and by comparing sentences. This is how you learn, supposedly, this is a theory of how the meaning of words is learned by a child. Tata pratamata eva karyanvita eva pavittes tatraiva shakti graha tata cha tatpartyam api tatraiva bhavet. Thus, since a person from the very beginning acts only in response to words that, as combined with other words in a sentence, connect to something that needs to be done. Only in such connections is the literal meaning of words recognized and should be the purport of statement. And only in such connections is the literal meaning of words recognized and should the purport of statements be found. Okay, now we have... words have their meanings. Letters, separate letters that make up words, don't really have meanings. Sometimes you imagine such meanings, but really they don't have meanings. The words, when you put letters together into a word, then the word has a meaning. Supposed to, in any language. That's a universal trait of language. The words have meanings. What meanings they have varies from language to language, but in every language, words have meanings. If you have a language in which the words don't mean anything, it's not really a language. It's some, you know, bebop or rap music, but it's not a language if the words don't have meanings. Now, here we have the Jaimini theory that the significant statements of the Vedas are only those that tell you to do something. So now, the Prabhakara school is extending that. Then in general, in all sentences, in all language, not just the Vedas, you may have set statements that are statements of fact, but are not directly telling you to do something, but you only learned what the words in those sentences mean from first of all having been told to do something, or hearing someone else being told to do something, and seeing the result. It's the only way you can learn the meaning of words. That's actually where the real shakti of words resides, in their ability to express an injunction, an instruction to do something. This is a theory. We don't agree with the theory, but it's there. This is the Prabhakara school. Actually, it's one branch of the Prabhakara school. This is called Karyanvita Shaktivad, that words don't really have separate meanings, each individual word. They don't. Although you look in a dictionary, they give you meanings, but that's artificial. Actually, words only mean anything in the context of a whole sentence. The words get meaning, have meanings only in syntactic connection with all the other words in a sentence. That's karya anvita. The meaning, the shakti. Shakti is the potency of a word to express its meaning. But they're saying the words don't have their individual potency all by themselves. They only express meaning in the context of a sentence. And you could say evidence for this is that when the sentence is different, sometimes, very often the word has a somewhat different meaning. According to what sentence it's in, the same word can mean different things. So it looks like, from that evidence, that yes, it's not the individual words that have the meaning, but only the words in the context of a whole sentence, and as connected by grammar and syntax to the other words in the sentence. Especially the verb, right? The verb is the most important word in the sentence, and all words, as the karakas, are directly connected to the verb. And the other words, the upapadas, are connected to the karakas. It's all connected to the verb. That's the Sanskrit theory of syntax. And the verb, to make a real sentence, a really important sentence, significant sentence, it should be an injunctive verb, a vidilin, or the equivalent. A direction to do something, something that needs to be done. Now, Jayamini's theory in general is that it's not necessarily that all statements have to be connected with something to be done. This is an extrapolation from Jayamini's original principle. He just says that only the statements of the Vedas that tell you to do something are important statements. Now, the Prabhakara school is extending that to all language and presenting what is called the Karyanvita Shaktivad, that words only have meaning in the context of a sentence. And not only that, but, okay, that's Prabhakara school. Then there's an even more radical sub-branch of the Prabhakara school. Not all the followers of Prabhakara agree with this, but one sub-branch say that the meaning of words is only known somehow by connection, directly or indirectly, with an injunction. That's even more radical. It's not only Karyanvitavad, but it's Anvayavad, Anvita Shaktivad. What is it called? I forget what the two theories are called. It's not Karyanvita is this more radical version, but the more general version is called Abhideya. Abhidakaryanvita Vad and Abhita Anvayavad and Anvita Abhidanavad. So, I'm sorry if I'm losing you, but I'm trying to give the background here. Prabhakara school, in general, they're presenting the Anvita Abhidanavad, that the meaning of words is there on the basis of connection of the words to other words by anvaya or syntax. Not individually the words have their meanings, but they get their meanings only in the context of the sentence. That's called anvita abhidana vad. The abhidana, or the significance of the word, has to be anvita in the context of the sentence. First the sentence and then the meaning of the words. Now there's another theory held by the Kumaralabhata school of Mimamsa. They call it, or it's called, Abhihita Anvayavad. That first the individual words have their meanings, and then those meanings are connected together by syntax to make a sentence. So first the Abhidana, Abhihita, past passive participle, what has a separate meaning, a word that has its own meaning, those words with their meanings or joined together to make a sentence by principles of syntax. Okay, so two different theories for the two major schools of Mimamsa. And then within that theory of Anvita Abhidanavad, first of all the syntax and then the meaning of the whole sentence, and then you can figure out artificially the individual meanings, but really the meanings are only there in connection with the sentence. There's a further extension of that theory to make it even more radical. It has to be Karyanvita Abhidhana. Karyanvita Shaktivad. That not only it has to be in the context of a sentence, the meaning of words is only in the context of a sentence, and on top of that, it has to be in connection with the idea of something to be done. That is the theory we're dealing with here, that's held by one sub-branch of the Prabhakara department of Mimamsa. That's Karyanvita Shaktivad. Now, it is criticized, and attempt is made to defeat that theory in the Navya Nyaya, the new Nyaya school founded by Gangesh Upadhyaya. And Gangesha wrote his masterwork in many volumes, the Tattva Chintamani. We have a copy of it upstairs. One of the hardest books ever written. But it's the textbook, standard, the foundational textbook of the Navya Nyaya school. He wrote this in the 10th century. Yes. The book or the... Gangesha. Gangesha Upadhyaya. So, in his book, he's dealing with the traditional topics of Nyaya, but he's giving a new analysis. And when he gets to Shabda Praman, because Nyaya deals with Pramanas, so eventually you get to the chapter of Shabda Praman. So he deals with different theories of how Shabda Praman works, and that's what we're talking about here in the Sarvasamvadini now. How does Shabda Praman actually work? So he deals with this theory of Karyanvita Shaktivad and tries to defeat it. And then someone called Gadadhar wrote a commentary where for 25 pages he elaborates on this criticism of this theory. Jiva Goswami is taking from that. Jiva Goswami is giving a summary of the Navanyaya reply, critical reply to this theory of the sub-branch of the Prabhakara school. This is about as esoteric as you get. This is what pundits, real hard-headed pundits, spend their time doing, quibbling over these things. Okay? I'm going to read the commentary. Let's see if I explained anything. Commentary. The objection raised here represents the opinion of a particular group within Jaiminis Mimamsa school, the school that puts forward a ritualistic interpretation of the Vedas. According to the general view of Mimamsa, our dharma, the purpose for which human beings exist, is to perform the duties prescribed for us in the Vedas. And the purpose of the Vedas is to prescribe those duties. Anything else the Vedas says is merely of secondary significance. One of Jaimini's sutras says, Amna yasya kriyartatvad anarktakyam atad artanam tasmaranityam uchyate. Because the revealed scriptures exist for the sake of activity, whatever they say that does not serve that end is not actually useful, and so it is said to be non-eternal. That's Jaimini's statement. Okay, then Shabara, he wrote the first main commentary on Mimamsa. This is before the Mimamsa school split up into the three branches. Shabara wrote his commentary, maybe 3rd century, 4th century AD. Shabara, in his commentary on this sutra, cites examples of such non-essential Vedic statements, such as Sorodid, Yadarodid, Tat Rudrasya Rudratvam. Rudra cried, and because he cried, he is called Rudra. Or that's the Rudratvam of Rudra. Although this statement gives us information about how Rudra obtained his name, it does not tell us what duties we should perform. In response to the suggestion that these duties should be inferred from the statement's context, Shabara asks, what duty could we infer? That because Rudra cried, everyone else should also cry? That makes a little sense. Therefore, such non-essential statements, even though found in the Vedas, do not have full Vedic authority. Shabara explains how it is that Jaimini calls them not eternal, even though they are part of the eternal Vedas. This is Shabara's explanation. Yajapi nityani tatapi nanityam artam kurvantiti. Although these, like the other statements, are of course eternal, because they're Vedic statements, they do not fulfill any eternal purpose. Okay, eternal purpose is performing a sacrifice. And it doesn't help you, doesn't inspire you to perform any sacrifice, so therefore it doesn't serve any eternal purpose. Therefore, Jaimini says, they're not eternal. Right, now we get into the Anvaya business. Words in a sentence each have their individual meanings. But the meaning of a sentence is more than simply the sum of all such meanings. Prabhakara, the founder of one of the two main branches of the Mimamsa school, takes this to imply that each word expresses its meaning only when combined with the other words of a sentence. And also contributing to the meaning of a sentence is the tatparya, the intention of the speaker. The statement, bring the saindava, for example, bring the saindava, is ambiguous because the word saindava can either mean salt or a horse from the Sindhu province. But from the context of the sentence, we should be able to know which of the two meanings the speaker intended. So if you're at lunch and someone says, bring the saindava, he probably doesn't mean a horse. He probably means salt. And if you're out, you know, about to take a trip, you know, ready to leave, and you say, bring the saindava, you probably mean a horse. The some persons, Sri Jiva mentions here, are actually one faction of Prabhakara's followers who incorporated into their general theory of word meanings the idea of the primary importance of Vedic injunctions. That's a standard Mimamsa idea, but now they're dragging it in to the theory of the meaning of words. So they're extending it radically. According to them, words used in sentences all refer, directly or otherwise, to man's dharma. All the words in all sentences, even regular language. The duties he should perform. Evidence of this, they say, can be seen in the way a child learns a language. The child first understands commands by seeing the actions they inspire. This is a theory. It's not necessarily true. But anyway, we're taking this as a theory. A child first understands commands by seeing the actions they inspire. Only later does the child begin to distinguish the individual meanings of words. Furthermore, even though in daily life we often use words without reference to anything that must be done. There's a fly on the wall. I'm not telling you to do anything about it. I'm just mentioning, oh, look, there's a fly on the wall. You may infer I want you to swat it or run out of the room or something else, but that I didn't say to do anything. We often use words without reference to anything that must be done, even though those words we learn first from commands. The word fly, the word wall. Anyway, they'll have to explain how all the words are originally connected to injunctions. Bring me a fly. This poor Rabaksha, the objection to be answered, and the following reply by a contending group of Prabhakara's followers have been adapted by Sri Jiva Goswami from Gangesha Upadhyaya's Tattva Chintamani, the principal textbook of the Navanyaya school. Okay. Atra ochite. Siddhe shatya bhavaha kuta. Kim sangati grahaka vyavaharasya siddhe bhavat. Tatrapi karya samsargitvad va. Nadya. Putra stejata ityari vakya janyasya prit. Pitradi shrotri vyavahara mukha vikashadir darshanat. Okay, here's the Gangesha's, or actually it's Gadadhar's commentary on Gangesha, where this is elaborated, and Jiva Goswami is taking from there. The response to this lies in a question. Why should an account of settled fact lack denotive power? You know, the claim is, okay, statements of mere fact don't have any real significance. Denotive power means the words don't really refer to anything important. Or, you know, they're saying, actually, that the words in a statement of fact may have meaning, but the original meaning of those words that they're just carrying into this new sentence originally comes with some connection with something that has to be done. Okay, so why should an account of settled fact lack denotive power? Is it because in a settled fact there is no activity to enable us to grasp the connection between the words and what they denote? Or is it because a so-called settled fact is also connected with something that needs to be done? Okay. Okay. One alternative is the words in a statement of mere fact don't have any connection with something that has to be done. Therefore, they don't mean anything, or they don't mean anything on their own. Or we can say there is an action that needs to be done, hiding somewhere in that sentence, even though it's apparently a statement of settled fact, that implied is some injunction. Well, it can't be the first, that there is no activity involved. Since we see that statements like a son has been born to you, okay, there's maybe not an injunction, but there is an activity. When we a statement like a son has been born to you, statements like that create a radiant face in the father and other effects in the hearers of similar statements. So there is an activity. A son has been born to you and the father starts smiling. That activity of smiling is connected to the sentence. Nor can it be the second. I didn't read the Sanskrit for that yet. Napi dvitiya karya samsargitvasya putva janmadava bhavat nachatrapi tam pasya ityadi kam karyam kalpyam. Okay, it can't be the second. Which is the second? Okay, that there is an activity, and actually an injunction, hiding in the statement of fact, implied by it. Nor can be it the second, because in such ideas as the birth of a son, there is no link to something that needs to be done. It's just, you have a son, he's born. There's no implied injunction there. I'm not telling you to do anything. In this second case, we should not presume something that needs to be done, such as look at him, because there are no grounds for this presumption. There's nothing in the sentence that implies that. Okay, the next sentence is complicated. I spent 4 years trying to figure it out. I thought I had it figured out, finally, and then Jayadevaran still is not satisfied with it, so it still doesn't make perfect sense. I'll give you my best version of it,
and you may not be satisfied with it. Here's the next sentence. Tat kalpaka bhavat. Oh, pratimika karyanvita shakti graha nupapatir eva tat kalpiketi chet. Na karyanvite vakye shakti graha siddhe. Karyapada eva karyanvita abhavena vyabicharat. Yogye taranvitatva matrena sangati grahopapattau visheshana vayardhyat cha. Okay, that is just a sentence, but it took me 4 years to try to do something with it. I went to Benares and spent 2 weeks there, consulted with some of the biggest scholars in Navinaya. They couldn't explain it. And I'm not an expert in Navinaya. I don't know hardly anything about it. I looked at all the commentaries. I went to Kanai Lal Adhikari in Navadvip. I asked him. Anyway, finally, I got something in my head that I think it might have been the answer. Let's see what I have here. Okay, we're saying, don't say that in the statement, a son is born to you, there's an implied injunction. Look at him. We're saying there's no reason to assume that. Okay, now they answer that. This is actually the Navinaya who are doing the criticism and the sub-school of Prabhakaras that are defending themselves. So the Prabhakarites, they say, one may suggest that the ground for such a presumption is that without it, one could not have had a first recognition of the meaning of the words, a meaning which should have been linked to something needing to be known, needing to be done. That means the words in the sentence, you as a child, you would never have learned what they mean unless they were originally connected with something to be done. Okay, now the Navinaya school, they answer this way. But no, the reason given that the capacity for meaning is found only in statements that relate to actions is not even valid. It's not even a valid reason. This is called Svarupa Siddha, Hetu Abbas, faulty reason, because the reason isn't even true. A siddha, it's not even true. There's fire on the mountain because there's smoke. But look, there's no smoke there. So your reason isn't even true. Therefore, your argument doesn't work. So it's not even true that the capacity for meaning is found only in statements that relate to action. Since in a statement, the very word that expresses the action is not connected through other words with something that needs to be done. Okay, what that means is, okay, you've got a sentence that expresses an action, maybe even an injunction. All the words are connected to the verb, but the verb itself isn't connected to any other word. The verb itself just has its own meaning. Its meaning does not depend on syntactic connection with an action. It's expressing an action by itself, but there's no syntactic connection with other words required for the verb to express the action. So your principle that all words have to have the meaning of all words have to have a syntactic connection with other words, ultimately with some action, especially maybe with some action that is an injunction, that's not true in the case of the verb in the sentence. So your rule is not universal. It's not a real reason. It's not true. It's not always true. That's actually called anaikantika. When a reason is not always true, it's maybe true some of the time, but not all the time. So it's not a universal principle. Like, you make a principle, people who don't get a college degree can't make a good living. You may say that, but it's not always true. I know some people who don't have a college degree and make a lot of money. So your principle is anaikantika. It sounds nice, but it's not always true. Okay, please bear with me. Now I'm going to try to continue. That's only one reason why the reason... Okay, the reason's not really valid, or it's not always valid. Also, were a relationship of meaning to be known as proposed simply from a statement's connection with some other suitable ideas, the words modifying the statement's verb would become useless. Wow, what is that? Let's see. Moreover, were a relationship of meaning to be known as proposed simply from a statement's connection with some other suitable idea. Okay. For each word in the sentence, we can figure out what the word means only in context of the whole sentence. So you have to know the meaning of the whole sentence before you can know the meaning of any of the words. Okay, fine. I look at one word, then somehow I know the meaning of the whole sentence. Maybe because I saw the boy bring the cow, so I know it means bring a cow. And I try to analyze what cow means. But if I can do that, if I, on the basis of knowing the meaning of the whole sentence, can figure out the meaning of each word, what's the use of words modifying one another? What's the use of having a karaka modify the verb if the meaning of the sentence is a whole and its meaning of the words depend on the meaning of the sentence rather than the other way around? What use is there in having modifiers? Like, horse is the karma, karaka, right? That is a kind of visheshanam of the verb, isn't it? It's, you know, the verb, I say bring, and the question is bring what? And the answer is expressed by the karma, by the object of the sentence. Cow, I'm bring horse. I make it cow. Bring cow. That's the object. But if I only knew, if I know what any of the words mean in the sentence by knowing, first of all, the meaning of the whole sentence, I just see, I learned what bring a cow means by seeing someone bring a cow after being told to do it. What use is it to have the word cow in the sentence? I already know the meaning of the sentence, so what do I have to modify? What do I have to say a special word to indicate the karma karaka? I think that's the argument here. The modifiers in a sentence become useless because the meaning of the sentence comes from the whole sentence. What is it? Well, yogitara, suitable. Well, idea means the meaning of a word. We know the meaning of a word by its meaning with certain other words in the sentence. Like, you know, the object, cow, has a purpose in the sentence in connection with the verb. It's the answer to what do you bring. If I just say cow, icicle, strawberry, that's not a meaningful sentence. The word cow is there, but it's not connected to anything. It has no syntactic purpose in the sentence. The word, you know, the words don't fit together in the syntax. But when I say bring the cow, cow makes sense in connection with the verb bring. That is a connection with a suitable idea, the idea of the verb, the action, in this case. The meaning of the word, the relationship of the word cow with the actual thing, a cow, is known only by its connection with some other meaning of some other words in the sentence, like the meaning of the action. That's the unvita abhidana theory. meaning, words have meaning only in the context of fitting together with other words to make a sentence.
I just got confused because it says that the statement's connection with some other suitable idea rather than like a word's connection with a... Like it seems like the whole
statement... Yeah, we're talking about a statement's meaning. Okay, I can't answer you right now. I don't know if that's what it should be. It would take me about an hour and a half to make sure about that. I'm just going to mark it for my reference and think about it. And then I'll look at it right now, but I don't think I can answer it quickly. Statement? Or is that supposed to be word? Now let me look at the Sanskrit and see if I can answer you. This is the most difficult sentence in the whole book. I still haven't gotten it right yet. It's not like the whole book is this much out of shape, but this one sentence is impossible. Karyapada eva karyanvita abhavena vyabhicharat. That was the first reason. This is the second reason. Yogetara anvitatva matrena sankti grahopapattau. Okay, problem is, we don't say the sankti of what? The connection. Graha, upapattau. Upapatti is a reason, actually. So there's a reason for the graha. Graha is the comprehension or the understanding of the connection. That's a syntactic connection. But it doesn't say of what. I took it to mean sentence. You're questioning, aren't we talking about the connection of the words or the meaning of the words? You may be right. Yogetara anvitatva matrena. That understanding of the connection is simply by the being syntactically connected with suitable other, to make it literal. I had to fill it in. You know, I said other ideas, and I said the coherence of the sentence. Maybe it's not sentence, but word. I can't do any better about that right now. Three reasons are given here, and they're not easy to understand. Third reason, let's go on to the third reason. You can think about it. If you can come up with a better explanation, let me know. Okay. Oh, visheshana vayartyacha. Third reason, because the modifiers are useless because of the superfluousness of the modifiers. I took that to mean, by the syntax of the whole sentence, you understand what each individual word means. So the fact of one word modifying another to make it mean something is irrelevant. Because it's the meaning of the words is there only in relationship to the whole sentence. If you took the individual meanings of words and let them modify each other, like you have lotus. You know what lotuses are. I could take a census of all the lotuses in the world and say there are 14 quadrillion lotuses, and I can tell you where each one is. You know, take a GPS machine and make a map of exactly where every lotus is in the universe. You know, 10,000 Japanese scientists can spend 10 years doing that. It can be done. And then I modify the word, blue lotus. Okay, now we just want to know, there are too many lotuses. Let's just look at the blue lotuses. So I've modified the word blue by the other word, lotus. And I've limited the concept. And now I'm just talking about blue lotuses. More specific concept. And we get a smaller census. And maybe the 10,000 Japanese scientists can find them all in 5 years. But that's when we're letting the words have their individual meanings. Then it makes sense that the meanings are further specified by modifiers. But if we have a theory where the words only have meaning in connection with the whole sentence, the meaning of the whole sentence, then what's the use of words modifying each other individually? No use. That means all the adjectives and all the karakas are useless. That's the argument. Okay, can I go on? Na chakarye karyan vitan vitatvam astiti vacham. Tand anvitatva yogad anavasta patescha. What does that say? Nor should it be even suggested that something that needs to be done can have a connection with something else that needs to be done, since there is no reason for linking one with the other, and indeed an endless regression would result. What is that talking about? Anybody want to guess? It's actually in reference to a specific suggestion that might be made. About a son has been born. It's proposed that there's implied an injunction. Look at him. Then you question, well, where does that come from? Why should you look at him? Why is it implied that you should look at him? Where does that implication come from? So what you have to do, what's suggested is that something that has to be done is connected with something else that needs to be done. We don't know where this look at your son comes from, but we can trace it back to a more basic injunction. Like it says in the so-and-so Veda, when your son is born, you should look at him for good luck. You know, if you don't look at him, it's bad. I don't think there is such an injunction. We're just imagining. Somewhere in some Veda, it says, when you have a son, you better look at him. Otherwise, it's bad luck. Just like it says in the Dharma Shastras, when a Brahmin passes stool, he shouldn't look at it. You know, so such injunctions are there. Suppose there's an injunction. When a son is born, you have to look at him. So that would be, that second injunction justifies the assumption of the first one. When I say a son is born to you, that implies you should look at him because there is the basic injunction, when a son is born, you should look at him. Of course, such an injunction doesn't exist. So, therefore, it shouldn't be suggested for two reasons. We shouldn't make that suggestion that there's a more basic injunction hiding behind the implied first injunction, since there's no reason for linking one with the other. And indeed, an endless regression would result. There's no real reason for claiming this. First of all, this second injunction, you won't find it anywhere in any Veda. You're making up something and it's not even there. Second, you'd have an endless regression because someone could say, well, why should you look at your son when he's born? Then you have to come up with another injunction to explain that. And then you have to go on forever. I don't know if that's an adequate argument, but those three sentences, I'm not ready to publish them yet. I'm not completely satisfied with the translation. It's the best I can do so far. Let me move on to the last two sentences of this paragraph. Na charkaryan vitatva eva pratamika shakti graha niyamaha siddhinirdeshepi balaka vyutpatir drishyate idam vastram ityadau. Okay, now it gets a little simpler. Nor is it a hard and fast rule that a meaning first learned must be connected with something that needs to be done. We're questioning their assumption. We see that a child may come to a proper understanding even in a matter-of-fact statement as when he is told, this is a piece of cloth. So the father, he's a cloth salesman, takes his son to the shop and says, this is a piece of cloth. This is what I sell. That's all. He's not telling him to do anything with it. And that's how the son learned what a piece of cloth is. Father showed him one and said, this is called a piece of cloth. Vastram. Just matter of fact, and the child learned from it. So where's this rule come from? Why do you insist that you only learn the meaning of words when they're connected with injunctions? Okay. I'll read the commentary and then we'll open for questions. The commentary is a little hard. Let's see if it explains things anymore.
In the exchange of objections and replies between the two parties of Prabhakara Mimamsakas, the proponents of the second view, or we got the two sides of the Prabhakaras arguing with each other now. The proponents of the second view, that statements need not always relate to something needing action. Oh, okay. So the less radical Prabhakaras say, well, why do you insist that all statements in all, and not in Vedas, but in all language, have to be directly connected to action, or even indirectly? Why do they have to be? There are statements of fact. So the less radical Prabhakaras don't insist on that. The proponents of the second view, that statements need not always relate to something needing action, ask their opponents what a declarative sentence lacks that prevents it from expressing a direct meaning. Declarative sentence just states a fact. After posing this question, they themselves offer two possible replies. One is that mere statements of fact do not elicit active responses that enable observers to learn the meanings of the words used. The other is that there is no such thing as a mere statement of fact at all, because every statement has some connection with an action that needs to be done. Both replies are invalid. Statements of fact do evoke these replies. This is the less radical Prabhakaras raised an objection, and now the more radical ones that say the meaning of all words has to be somehow connected with an injunction. They gave these two replies, but they're not valid. Statements of fact do evoke responses in their hearers, responses that inform the hearers about a conversation's meaning. And many simple declarative statements have no link to a need to do something. Persons who insist there is such a link may presume there is an unspoken injunction behind every statement of fact. But this presumption has no apparent justification. Someone may suggest that young Chaitra could originally have learned the meaning of the statement, "A son has been born to you," only in the context of hearing an injunction to a father, say, such as, "Take a look at him." Okay, now we're presenting the case that Chaitra, when he was a little boy, he learned, before he had any sons, he learned what the sentence means, "A son has been born to you," when it happened to somebody else. And he heard, "A son has been born to you," and then he also heard the second sentence, "Look at him." Then Chaitra figured out what it all means. That is, the statement used again in a second circumstance must still imply an injunction to act. So when Chaitra himself has a son, and they say, "A son has been born to you," Chaitra remembers, "Oh, I know what that means. I remember that. That means I'm supposed to look at him." The proponents of the second view respond with several objections. That means the less radical Prabhakaras. They respond with several objections. First, grammatically or logically, nothing inherent in the statement "a son has been born" implies you should look at him. There's nothing in the sentence that says that or implies it. If Chaitra had instead been told a big angry bull is running toward you, one could easily infer that because, as a rule, big angry bulls are dangerous, Chaitra should do something to avoid this one. But "a son has been born to you" doesn't necessarily imply the imperative "you should look at him." Second, in an imperative sentence, the verb itself breaks the rule that all meaningful words must have at least an implied link to an enjoined action. That is to say, in an imperative sentence, the verb itself expresses what needs to be done, and it is the main word of the sentence. The subject, predicate, and other modifiers are all syntactically connected to the verb, but the verb is independent. Therefore, an imperative verb has no syntactic relation to other words expressing action. When a child learns what a cow is by hearing his father tell his older brother, bring the cow and milk it, how does the child learn what bring and milk mean? By seeing directly the actions represented by the words. But that makes even an imperative verb, a siddhapada, a word describing actual fact, like bring and milk, describe actions that are facts. Not only nouns express facts, verbs can express facts also. It's raining. It rains. Rain is falling. That's a statement of fact. A word, that means even an imperative verb, is a siddhapada, a word describing actual fact, which according to Jaimini has no real significance of its own. As in, so by that argument, even the injunctions don't have any meaning in the Vedas. As interpreted by the first faction of the Prabhakara followers of Jaimini, words and sentences gain meaning only when they connect with injunctive verbs, commands, injunctions. Nouns referring to things mean nothing by themselves. But there is no real difference between learning what bring means by seeing the act of bringing and learning who your father is by seeing one's mother point to a man and say, "This is your father." In fact, actions expressed by verbs are as much things as the things expressed by nouns. The only difference being that nouns describe things that have some stability to their existence, whereas verbs describe things in a process of change. Both are still things. When the father issues the order, bring the cow, the act of bringing, although yet to be realized externally, already exists as a thing with some stable existence, the intention in the father's mind. Third, besides the verb, other words in a sentence have meaningful syntactic connection with one another. No matter how three-year-old Chaitra learned what the words son, born, and your mean, now Chaitra is grown up, and he can easily piece together the idea of your son has been born without having to conjure up any injunction. Okay, maybe he learned it from an injunction, but now he doesn't need to use an injunction to figure out what it means. He knows what the words mean, what the sentence means. Putting the words into Sanskrit, let's take the sentence Tava Putra Jata, your son has been born. If Chaitra knows enough Sanskrit grammar, he will recognize Putra as a subject case noun, Jata as a past participle serving as the verb of the sentence, and Te as a short form of the possessive pronoun Tava, your. The verb has its subject, and the subject has its possessive modifier. Your son is born. Thus, with no need for any injunction of an action yet undone, these three words, with their grammar and their dictionary meanings, express the complete idea, and Chaitra should be able to understand it. As a last resort for salvaging the rule that all words must link with something to be done, one might propose that imperative verbs connected with another, that imperative verbs, we're over time. Okay, this is the last paragraph. Then we'll have to hold the questions till tomorrow. You may want to write down your questions so you don't forget them. As a last resort for salvaging the rule that all words must link with something to be done, one might propose that imperative verbs connect with other unspoken imperatives. One could assume that the word look and you should look at him is connected with the previous injunction, like, for the good fortune of one's newborn child, one should look at him at once. But what logical reason sustains this assumption? The supposed injunction that one needs to look at a newborn son, child, is not recorded in any shastra. Other attempts to manufacture previous injunctions will also result in imaginary injunctions or pairs of injunctions that don't follow logically from one another. Okay, either you're going to make up injunctions that don't exist, or you may find a real injunction, but there's no logical connection between one and the other. You know, you're going to come up with, to make something relevant, you're going to create an imaginary injunction in most cases, or you may come up with a real injunction, but there's no relevance. It has no logical connection with the injunction you want it to lead to. It doesn't lead. And applying thoroughly the rule that injunctions by implication must be connected with previous injunctions would result in an infinite regress, each imperative needing support from an infinity of previous ones. Okay, that's the commentary. If there's anything that doesn't make sense, make a note of it, and we'll discuss it tomorrow. Okay? This is important. So don't neglect to do this, because we have to catch anything that's weak here. We have to try to fix it. Okay, we have no time to discuss right now, but try to remember or make a note of it, and we'll start tomorrow morning with the discussion. If you need to go over some of it again, let me know tomorrow morning. If it's just a question of what the hell does this mean, let me know that also. Okay. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.